Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, seriously researched, hard-hitting history podcast told through entertaining stories. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks, everybody.
The Bear.
You're listening to the best of the Bears.
He's in for the touchdown, and the Chicago Bears have taken the lead.
A weekly mix of 670 The Score's best NFL talk to get you ready for game day.
Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is
Layla Rahimi, Marshall Harris, Rahimi and Harris. Middays 10 a.m. to 2 on 670 The Score.
There is no depth chart right now. If you want to play, you got to go earn it. If you want a role, you got to go earn it. They know that. I think all we did this weekend was we might have just turned up the notch just a couple of dials for certain people in the building. So that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing. That's where you bring out the best, not only in your team, but what I'm going to be curious to see is what guys look like when the ball's not in their hands on offense.
That's Ben Johnson talking about accountability, which I swear was a theme word of the Bears ever since October of last year. No better person to talk about it than Dan Wiederer. He is in for Marshall Harris today and Rahimi and Harris on The Score. And I wanted to originally talk to you about an article you just wrote, but what you said in the last conversation about the draft board got me thinking about how you and I perhaps listen to press conferences the same way. I just kept thinking to myself, when I heard Ben Johnson there, or when I heard even Matt Eberflus previously, or when I heard Ryan Poles, the continual discussion of accountability, especially when Ben Johnson was introduced.
Right.
I was like, who is he talking to?
Yeah.
I felt like a coach was specifically talking to one player on the team, or maybe two.
It's hard to say. I mean, there's certainly subtext, and you've got to kind of sift through it and see what happens. What I'm fascinated to see, and I actually asked Ben this in his introductory press conference, is what does accountability look like to you? Because that's, as you mentioned, since last October, it's been the buzzword inside of House Hall. We need more accountability. We need more accountability.
Is it in the room with you right now? Blink twice if you're in trouble.
And essentially, his answer was that, look, like, we have to establish very clear, defined standards. And when people fall short of that standards, there has to be consequence to that. And so that's where it is, right? Like that's the big word there. Consequence. What are the consequences when people fall short? We spent years of the Matt Eberflus era talking about the hits principle. Oh, we're going to grade the effort on every single play of every single practice and every single game. Okay, cool. Really good in principle. But if there are no consequences to not or not strong enough consequences to not meeting the standard, then what good is it? And then we see that stuff play out in real time when your cornerback is not where he's supposed to be on a game-deciding play in a loss that ends up torpedoing your entire season, and it takes days to come to any sort of conclusion. And the conclusion was really kind of, it didn't feel full-hearted, right, in the way they handled Tyreek Stevenson after that play. And even, you know, weeks later, Tyreek Stevenson in an interview with Mark Potash still didn't seem to understand what exactly he did wrong responsibility-wise on the play. You know, not just the interactions with the fans, but understanding who he was supposed to be with on the play and why he was not supposed to go and jump and tip the ball that Kevin Byard was supposed to knock down into the hands. There has to be consequence for those things, right? Like, and so it goes offense, defense, special teams. You have to have coaches initially that establish the consequence. And then I think the goal of Ben Johnson and his staff is eventually to turn it over to veteran players to make sure that they have the voice and the resources needed to make sure that stuff doesn't happen. But that's going to be a huge conversation for the 2025 Bears. Now we need to see the action behind accountability.
Right. And what's funny is I feel like they feigned it at times. Chase Claypool's on the PUP list to start the season. Inexplicably, Jalen Johnson, who was out of an OTA for a legitimate reason, you know, the golf tournament, observing his childhood friend who had passed away. Yeah. That he's starting with the threes. Like there were, it's like, the easy punishment was easy for you.
Right.
But once it came into how you're going to have to hurt your team because somebody's lack of focus hurt the team for the rest of the season, that's when it got out of control. And I don't think that there's any doubt that that 10-game losing streak was a part of all of that. Like, you wonder how one loss beat you twice, beat you thrice, beat you into seemingly infinity. Also, Robbie Triano just let me know, we have the question that you asked, Dan, about accountability to Ben Johnson. Let's listen for reference.
How do you define accountability under your watch?
Yeah, accountability is really, we're going to do what we say we're going to do, and we're going to be who we say we're going to be. And if we fall short of that standard, then there has to be consequences to that. That can look a number of different ways, but we are going to get to the point when we are winning here where our veteran players are going to take over the accountability portion of it. Until we get there, though, it's going to be on us as the coaching staff to outline what it should look like, what a Chicago Bear is going to look like, what that professional work ethic is going to look like.
There's a lot packed in there.
That's it. And I keep thinking about it, and I just keep wondering, I don't know that a head coach would say that about a cornerback. You know, I understand that was a terrible thing that happened. We talked about it for sure. Talk radio basically lit itself on fire because people couldn't wait to discuss it and continue to do so. But again, the relative scale of players of importance, who's number one?
Well, and he also talks about professional work ethic, which marries up with all that, right? And figuring out how those things kind of go hand in hand. By the way, just listening to that sound clip again, like I'm definitely in a honeymoon phase as a reporter with talking to Ben Johnson. I feel like every conversation you have with him is detailed. There's valuable insight and information that comes out of every exchange. I love that as a reporter. We've sat through so many years of the John Fox era, who, by the way, like, John was so much better after he was the Bears coach than he was while he was the Bears coach, of Eberflus. You hear all this hollow stuff. Like, with Ben, like, you feel like you're getting places when you have these sessions with him, whether it's a huge press conference, whether it's a one-on-one at the owners' meetings, wherever it is, you feel like you're learning and gaining valuable insight into his vision and his approach. I think this is going to be fun here for a lot of people in Chicago to kind of have this refreshing, open book, insightful way of learning about the football team that they follow so closely.
I love the analytical brain that he has when it comes to just thinking through every step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that shows.
It's intense.
I feel like the mathematical way he sees a field is the same. You know, it's geometry for him. It's angles. It's how you're using the whole field, that type of deal. That makes sense to me as a play caller and as a head coach. I also want to ask you this, though, because I remember when I got here and Matt Nagy took over for John Fox, mm-hmm. I remember being happy about the transparency at the time.
Sure.
I remember feeling like it was a breath of fresh air in a way.
Sure.
But the other piece of this that I think we probably discredit, thanks in part to an article you wrote, was how betrayed John Fox was by Ryan Pace at the end.
At the end. I mean, it was before they started their final season together, right?
Right.
Like that, like the trust had been permanently fractured, and you're like, it's one of those moments where you're like, man, like that's how you become an organization that goes a quarter century without any sort of sustained success, because you're just broken in too many meaningful ways too often, and there's not enough guardrails or checks and balances or things to keep that in line, you know. And so for them to basically go into the 2017 season with a head coach and a general manager that didn't want to work with one another anymore, it's jarring, right? Like, and you have to live that through the entire rookie season of a quarterback you traded up to draft at number two
secretly. So when we talk about whose draft it is, 100%, you know, that was Ryan Pace.
Yes, yeah, we do know that.
Fault.
We do know that one for sure.
But yeah. I do remember that time where we were appreciative of what Matt Nagy was talking about.
And the other thing we were appreciative of is that Matt Nagy won 12 football games and the city was electric and it was alive and it was like, oh yeah. You know, like Manley talks about this all the time about being a young player and being told by some of the veterans, I think Big Cat Williams being one of them, of like, just wait till we win here. Like, you have no idea what Chicago is like when the Bears are winning. Modern day, I think all the time about Cole and Jalen. These guys came in 2020. They haven't experienced any sort of meaningful success during their Bears career. It's very realistic to say that both of them are at least halfway done with their NFL careers, right? Like, they're 5 years in already, and you can hear every grain of sand in their hourglass dropping through. You know how badly they want to win here. And so it's like, those are the guys that I hope really feel the urgency and convey the urgency in this new program as some of the veteran leaders that are like, guys, like, we're tired of being told to wait around. It's coming, it's coming, it's coming. And then it's not coming. We're just rebooting once again at quarterback or GM or coach or whatever it may be. Like, those guys have lived it now, right? Like, and like, when you think of that through professional livelihood, like, oh God, did I just experience half of my career, particularly a guy like Cole who grew up here, right? And
right.
You know how much it means to him. I hope those guys are able to take some enforcement of this football team going forward.
Dude, I will never forget last season. It was Jason Leisure's article and the quotes from Kyler Gordon and how sad they were. They were legitimately sad, where he's talking about how he's in the best physical time of his career and he's unfortunately watching it go away because he's playing on a team that doesn't know how to win. And he wasn't that indictment centered about it. That's my paraphrasing. Sure. The way he said it was much more, I think, understanding and passive. There was not an accusatory tone, but just sad.
Like, this sucks, right? Like, that's the overtone. I was like, this sucks. Like, I'm wasting a year of my professional prime for a team that can't get itself right.
And I'm very player centric. You know, I am. I listen to players. I feel like they tell you more in what they don't say, they'll tell you more. Like, that's why I feel like windows are dictated by players. They're not dictated by executives. They're not dictated by coaches. That's how I feel. Those are the ones on the field. That's it for me. So when I hear players talk like that, it resonates so much, because I do wonder if the real benefit in getting guys like Joe Tooney on this team isn't just for what you're going to see on the line. It's to help people when they say things like that.
Right. And it's to, you know, set an example every single day and be the one that is the guy that people want to follow.
Well, and also to prevent the slumps from happening that are so long, to prevent a 10-game losing streak. Somebody's got to be like, hey, man, I won games. Settle down. This is not that bad. And I'm not saying that people are blowing things out of proportion, but somebody to say, nah, we can stop this. Here's how. Or like, just have that mentality, because it does matter in a locker room to a football season. Look, it sometimes is about emotion rather than X's and O's.
It's oftentimes about emotion rather than X's and O's. And so, like, I mean, obviously the X's and O's are going to supersede things, but you have to be able to manage that week, right? Like, and where are we now psychologically? You came out of Washington. You knew that team was really, really crushed by what happened there. You went to Arizona, and that game got away from you. The next week, that there was that home game against New England, and it was the ultimate get-right game against an opponent with a rookie quarterback that wasn't very good, and you got him on your home turf, and if you just play a mediocre to above-average brand of football, you walk out of there with a win, and everything settles down.
And a coach in turmoil, by the way. So right. You know, look in the mirror a little bit there.
Right. And they never had a chance in that game, right? Yeah. Like, and that was the one where you're just like, oh boy. And I think that was Shane's last game, if I'm not mistaken.
Waldron's.
And then there you go. There's the spiral. I mean, man, it's hard to relive that spiral when you go back through that period. I mean, when you go between, again, Halloween and New Year's Day without winning a single football game, like, no one can take that.
It was also just the little things, though. And it will be about this for me a lot of ways on the football field. It will be about how successful your first drive is.
Sure.
Because after Shane Waldron left the building, it still wasn't successful. And that will indicate, you know, what's your preparation like during the week? You know, these are the details where you find out who your team is. You know, we talked about the Cubs a little bit earlier and their success in first games of the season. And we got a break because Ian Happ's coming up, actually, right, guys? So I want to ask him about that meeting, for example, the preparation that they have. You know, no better person to ask than an athlete next. We got real deep in the weeds there, but that's what you get to do when you don't have a game to talk about for the Bears.
Layla Rahimi, Marshall Harris, middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Yeah, all these guys are capable of really producing with the ball in the hand, and it also puts a lot of stress on the defense where, you know, we're looking at good looks, and that plays right into Ben's hands in terms of how he wants to attack each week.
That was Ryan Poles, as we know, and we go to the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline to bring in our next guest on Rahimi and Harris, Dan Wiederer in. For Marshall Harris, it is our friend Mike Sando of The Athletic at work again, this time writing articles about what other executives think about other teams' drafts. Always nice to talk to Mike, especially after the quarterback tier story and the beast that just came out where they, again, upgraded that user interface online. So, Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I can't take credit for the beast, but it does look pretty good on there, doesn't it?
Well, you know, I said that because we've had Dane on, of course, Dane Brugler. But after you and I talked about the graphic support, I think that went with the quarterback team story. I couldn't help but notice that they did the same thing with the beast.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a good team, and it's really made progress in that area. I think a lot of our stuff looks better, and agreed, the beast was, that had to be a beast to do for such a big, you know, document.
Well, now we get to follow up with the draft. And I think it's a really cool concept, the idea of being able to talk to other executives, remaining anonymous about other teams' drafts. So naturally, we wanted to get your gauge on what was said about the Bears. What were your main takeaways?
Yeah. Generally positive. You know, I think they can see it's a coach-driven draft at the top when you're taking two weapons like that. And maybe that's okay because your coach is the star of the show now, and he did such a great job in Detroit with the pieces he had. So there's probably a little bit of trust that, you know, people think highly of Ben Johnson and think that if he likes a couple guys here, that he's going to be able to get the use out of them. It was interesting before the draft, you know, some of the rankings had had Ty Warren, who ended up being drafted by the Colts at 14 as the top tight end. But the people that I talked to thought it was going to be Colston Loveland, who the Bears took, just because he's more dynamic as a receiver. So I think that was generally applauded. You know, they've thrown a lot at the receiver and tight end positions. So, you know, that's okay because they did address their offensive line quite a bit earlier this offseason. I'd say just generally, you know, generally pretty positive and understanding of what the Bears are doing.
Mike, the Loveland buzz has been louder and certainly more amplified after the draft than it was before the draft. What is your sense of what excites people around the league at what his potential is, obviously playing in an offense that should feature him?
Yeah, well, just the ability to get open, which isn't a given with tight ends. There's different types of tight ends. Some of them are, you know, better blockers. Some of them are, you know, well-rounded, pretty good at both blocking and receiving. But I think what's differentiating the guys at the top, usually, if you want to take one early, is their ability to separate and get open on their own. So people think he can do that. And that's, like I said, that differentiates him a little bit in the minds of some from the second tight end in the draft, Warren. So that's what it is, ability to, you know, to almost operate like a receiver from the tight end position.
I think it's also valuable when it comes to just the overall impression of, we've asked the question before, whose draft is this? And that was one where the pick was so indicative of the hallmarks of a Ben Johnson need. You know, what was your takeaway when it came to that part of this, was not just the comments about Ben Johnson's needs specifically, but the overall draft?
Yeah, agreed. And I also think that it was a draft where, by the time the Bears were picking, it wasn't like there was a no-brainer person to pick. You kind of had your choice of a lot of different things, right? You could say in some other years, even last year, you know, it worked out a little similarly where, like, Joe Alt was this great tackle available, and he ended up not being available by the time the Bears picked, I think, at number 9. But, you know, if there's somebody like that, that's just a no-brainer. But if they were going to address, you know, people wanted them to get a running back, well, there isn't really one you're going to take there, you know, at 10. Offensive line, yeah, there were some kind of guard tackle types, but you did that in free agency. You didn't necessarily have to do that. So you know, I did think it set up a little bit more easily to take a piece that the coach likes, as opposed to feeling like, oh my gosh, the number one corner's available. We have to get him. There weren't players like that in this draft at number 10.
Mike, on day two, they picked Luther Burden, and it's another weapon for Ben and Caleb to utilize. There was some sentiment initially that that's a luxury pick for this team, given where they're at. And then there's this post-draft buzz that best case scenario is Luther Burden becomes a Pro Bowl difference maker for your offense for a long time. What's your sense on kind of how he's viewed and kind of the pluses and minuses of making that pick where they made it?
Yeah. I think you could find many mock drafts before the draft that had him going a lot earlier, going in the first round. So I think people are understanding of the value you, looks like you're getting in the second round, and think that, you know, it could be a little bit of a luxury because you've got other receivers. Now, they have different skill sets, so I'm not saying he's the same as all the other receivers, but, you know, if you want the ball in somebody's hands, you could say DJ Moore could, mm-hmm. you know, do some things after the catch as well. So I think that's a fair point to bring up. You know, you could call it a criticism that, you know, maybe it was a bit of a luxury pick. I think it was interesting that, you know, the pick before that the Patriots took Travion yes. Henderson, the running back. I think that's interesting. I probably could have got into that in the analysis, probably should have. But I thought what was interesting about that is that Henderson is seen as a pass protection piece, mm-hmm. not just a runner. Really could help your pass protection. He's a great, willing pass blocker. So, you know, if both those players were available at yep. that pick, you'd probably lean towards Henderson, right?
No doubt. And I think, yeah, I think there was a push to try to make that happen. And then they had to, I don't want to say settle, but, you know, pivot, I guess, is yeah. a better way to put it.
Well, and we've been trying, Mike, yeah. to figure out what the Bears' counterpunch was after that, because then they go another six rounds before they get a running back. You know, they go to the seventh round. So that's been a discussion yeah. that we've been having, is just the thought on if that was truly a position of need versus them talking a lot about their board.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fair point. I mean, certainly they could have taken one earlier, but, you know, as sometimes there's, you really only like certain players, right? So there could be other backs that they would have been fine with, but it just didn't feel like it was adding what they wanted to add at the expense of something else they could have gotten later in the draft. Like, you know, I think people liked they took an offensive lineman at 56. People like that pick. You know, that maybe if you're going to do luxury with Burden, you come back with meat and potatoes with offensive line, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and then we're like, okay, now we're three picks into this thing. We haven't taken anyone on defense. So, okay, let's get this defensive tackle, Turner, right?
Yep.
And so you can kind of see how that goes. And now, shoot, we don't like these packs that are here in this next range the same. That's how that happens.
I think also when it came to just the executive opinion, you know, that was addressed in some of these quotes. Like, for example, when they're talking about, well, that's a lot of resources at the tight end position, that there is some acknowledgement of either perhaps some overlapping positional possible redundancy or yeah. an understanding of the yeah. availability of what was there at the draft that they wanted.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And when I look at where they were, so remember I said, like at 132, they took the linebacker. Well, at that point, you know, mm-hmm. a running back had come off five picks before. Another one had come up, two others had come off a couple before that. Scadaboo had come off. A lot of people liked him, special teams guys. So, you know, that's the board falls how it falls. And if you want to make a maneuver and move up to get a guy, you're going to pay for that. And it may just not have seemed worth it to them. And I think you have to trust Ben Johnson a little bit in terms of what he has on offense, what he thinks he needs, and he got what he wanted. Oh, clearly, they didn't pass on a running back when he wanted to have one. I would almost guarantee that.
Mike, two-part question here. You had quoted an executive in your piece about Ozzie Trapillo saying that he could be the sleeper of this class for the Bears. I'm curious what kind of buzz you heard about what makes him that. And then on a bigger picture sort of look, when you draft a tackle in a top 60 of a draft, what have to be the realistic expectations for what he is going to be for you, for your football team for the long haul?
I think that high, you're hoping to get a starter. It may not be a starter right away, but I think you'd really like to get a starter out of that second pick, and maybe he starts, you know, maybe it's the second year or whatever. But you know, I think he played a lot of right tackle in Bill O'Brien's offense there at Boston College. So, you know, I believe the Bears have Darnell Wright there, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
And so we'll see what the future is for him, you know, and where he's going to go. But that could be, you know, this could be a swing tackle, somebody for you. This could be, you know, an eventual starter at right tackle, depending what you think is going to happen with, you know, with Wright in terms of either changing positions or where he fits into their future on an extension, those sorts of things. You can't have enough of those guys at that position. And so if you like a guy, you take him and you work him into the mix.
Mike, I know that you've mentioned the Bears is getting high marks from this random executive pool that you talked to. But what was another team in the NFC that stood out to people as far as how they performed in the draft?
People loved the Rams getting a first-round pick next year. Sometimes those first-round picks seem really great, don't they, until you have to actually use them. But the idea of doing that when you may need a quarterback next year, I think a lot of people like that. People didn't like the other side of it with Atlanta giving that away, even though they liked some of their players. You know, let's see. I scroll through some of these teams. I think people liked... you know, you could kind of... The Giants. I think the Giants were another one as I go through this, just because the market sort of proved they were correct in not taking a quarterback at two. There was sort of debate of, like, how early do they need to take a quarterback? Or at three, I guess. They took Abdul Carter instead of kind of panicking and taking... You know, Shedeur Sanders or Jackson Dart or somebody that they liked at three because they felt like they needed to have a quarterback. So I think that was decent, good process. And then, you know, I don't know if Jackson Dart's going to be any good, but you at least addressed that position, got the next quarterback and somebody they obviously liked. So, and then Cam Scataboo also was seen as an interesting pick in the fourth round, running back who could kind of almost affect your culture just by the way he plays on special teams and the energy he brings. I think that was a pick that I talked to more than one executive who was like trying, you know, hoping that their team would have taken him.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I think he was on the radar here as well. Layla mentioned earlier your QB tiers piece, and that's one of those annual summer Christmas morning pieces where you're pretty excited for it to come out. I'd imagine that even though that doesn't launch until August, you're well on your way to compiling some of this, correct?
You really can't start till after the draft because that's when you know who's starting in the different places, right?
Okay.
So you can't. We had to see who's going to draft quarterbacks, where's Russell Wilson going to land, all those types of things. So I think it'll get going a little bit here soon.
Aaron Rodgers also on that list. I'm just curious, what do you expect you might hear that be the first year that Caleb Williams will be folded into that? Because obviously rookies aren't eligible for it. But what do you expect to hear? What are some of your early takes on where Caleb is right now?
Yeah, probably some criticism of his first year playing and taking too many sacks, you know, and just probably not being as good as people thought he was going to be. You could say what you want about the situation around him. And then I think there'll be talk about what Ben Johnson can do with him and how Ben Johnson is, you know, I think Ben Johnson's a little bit of an old school coach. I think he coaches people hard and holds them accountable. So I think that'll be an interesting situation for Caleb Williams there in Chicago.
Mike, I do remember talking to you about Lamar Jackson pretty intently after the last one came out. Does anything change after this past season? Because I thought he was a tier lower.
Well, he was right on the edge of tier one and tier two. So, you know, I would imagine that he would bump into tier one. I would think so after last year. Yeah.
I was curious about that. Not that I need to scoreboard anybody. Goodness knows I've been wrong on a million things, but I did wonder if his past season would put him back in that top tier.
Well, he has never been there before in tier one. He's always been close, but, you know, I think the way he's not so much this year or even last, but, you know, the way that it hasn't translated to the postseason and you know, has kept him sort of, and concerns about his passing in the past, you know, kept him a little bit lower, but he really moved right to the edge of it this last year. And so, I'm going to look at it. I was going to look at it now. It's not popping up, but just, he was close. He had a lot of tier one votes. So I would think that enough of those would swing over. He'll be in tier one with probably Patrick Mahomes, Joe Burrow, Josh Allen, and we'll see who else.
Mike, we look forward to it. And until then, we get to check out not only your story about executives talking about the draft, but I know one was just released, executives talking about free agency as well. So we will look forward to those. And thanks for joining us here on Raheem and Harris on The Score.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Nice to talk to Mike Sando always, especially when there is that embarrassment of riches resource-wise there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like that's something you look forward to too, the quarterback tiers.
Oh yeah, because it's so informed, right? Like that's the best part of it is it's not Mike's rankings, right? Like Mike reaches out all over the league and gets such a wide array of opinions that help you crystallize how the entire league views all of these quarterbacks, and it's fascinating to see how it stacks up every year.
Well, and I thought that it was compelling that the Giants got such high marks for their draft after everything that happened.
Sure.
Yeah, we're still trying to figure out. Right now, they still have four quarterbacks in the room, right? They haven't made a move on DeVito yet, have they?
No.
Your guy.
ILO.
I, right?
See, I got you to do it. There you go.
I like the Illini.
Spiegel and Holmes.
I'm just saying, Lawrence, you were saying some stuff last week, if my memory is correct.
That's why Danny left.
Afternoons on the Score.
I'm a competitor, so, you know, every day show up, compete. You know, coming into a new program, my main goal now is to just get on the field as soon as possible. I've mentioned that before. But well, you know, well-rounded, disciplined player. Going to play hard, play tough, but also play smart and under control. You know, don't let emotions get the best of me. Try and stay, you know, in the moment at all times, very focused and, you know, disciplined.
New Bears tackle. I don't know whether to put left or right in front of that, so I'll just say tackle. Ozzie Trapillo discussing his role on the team and what he's going to try to do to make this team. It's the Spiegel and Holmes show. We're here with you until 6 o'clock. Little NFL breaking news. Justin Tucker has been cut by the Ravens.
It's very interesting the way that they phrased this. I think everybody understands what's been happening with the massage lawsuits and the multiple masseuses coming out of the woodwork to pile on. This is the phrasing from Ravens executive vice president and general manager Eric DaCosta. Sometimes football decisions are incredibly difficult, and this is one of those instances. Considering our current roster, we have made the tough decision to release Justin Tucker. Justin created many significant and unforgettable moments in Ravens history. His reliability, focus, drive, resilience, and extraordinary talent made him one of the league's best kickers for over a decade. We are grateful for Justin's many contributions while playing for the Ravens. We sincerely wish him and his family the very best in this next chapter of their lives. What do you make of the phrasing up top there, Lawrence Holmes, on football decisions and considering our current roster?
There is an argument to be made that he should have been cut during the season last year because he missed a lot of big kicks for the Ravens. I do think it's interesting that they wanted to put it out and say, look, no, this is totally just a football decision that we're making. I need to know what his roster bonus would be and if they're going to designate him as like a June 1 guy. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I want to kind of get into the weeds about to figure out if it's actually a football decision that was made here.
They drafted a kicker as well. So they did that. But yeah, his bad performance last year gives them
a lot of cover
out.
If that's what they wanted to do.
His cap hit is $6.9 million in 2027. Cap hit now in 25 is $7 million and seven again in 26. So $7 million for a kicker doesn't happen a lot.
For a kicker that's missing kicks.
Yeah.
And missing big kicks while you think that you're in a Super Bowl window.
They don't have to declare any sort of moral stance in doing this.
Sure don't. They can just be rid of him. I mean, he is 35. So this is the point where kickers are often starting to not be their best. But when you look at the numbers last year, he only made 73% of his field goals.
I mean, before last year, you had a case to call him the greatest of all time.
100%. And then it just fell apart. And now there's the other stuff, too. So the Ravens can definitely use this as cover if they want. Or maybe they just said, yeah, this is a football decision. Although I think that the football decision part of it probably should have happened right as the season ended. But that's why I want to know some of the contract language, because I do wonder if there was an amount of money owed him if he's still on the roster June 1, and you just get ahead of that and you leave him sure. to his own devices on figuring out his life.
They don't have to do it. They don't have to declare, as we're talking about, but my opinion is that he would have gotten another year to try and rebound and continue his career if not for that stuff.
You're probably right. Because, yeah, but why? Like, if you're saying you're bringing shame to the family,
uh-huh.
and you're not kicking and you're at the bad. Highest level possible, and you're expensive, you put all three of those things together and you got cut.
Do the Browns have an opening at kicker? Do they? Who's the Browns kicker?
I don't think they're going to. Well, I mean, I shouldn't put anything past the Browns, but that would be a mistake.
Can you imagine being Jimmy, what's his name?
Haslam.
Being Jimmy Haslam and being like, that's my guy.
Him and Deshaun. Let's get them together. That'd be a terrible thing. The door is wide open for Shador to just, he could take the whole thing over.
He's got to beat Dylan Gabriel.
Yeah, so Cleveland's kicker is Dustin problem. Hopkins, and he kind of sucked last year.
He did?
So, yeah, 18 of 27.
Yeah. I don't think anybody's going to take a flyer on Justin Tucker, which is
not for a while.
Which would have happened 100%, you know, in a parallel universe. He wouldn't have been cut, but if he was cut,
I think that there's an argument to cut him on football alone.
Oh no, that's why they don't have to declare.
But
another team would have been
that's
like,
"What this is?"
I don't think so.
But the argument is there to do it on its face, and maybe it should have been done in like week 12 last year, but. Oh, well.
Here they are. It's Slim Pickens for NFL Storylines right now.
Love his albums.
I did find myself looking at a bunch of power rankings post-draft because I saw one, and then I'm like, well, I wonder, did everybody do one after the draft? And the answer is yes. Everybody did a power ranking.
Well, yeah, because that's part of the thing. Like, you do all of your draft stuff. People read that. They get excited about players that are not going to play for their team.
Yeah.
And they get mad because people told you were going to draft this tight end, and then you drafted another tight end.
So I am looking at the results of 9 different power rankings.
Okay.
Because we are in the knowledge acquisition business.
Who are the power rankings by? So it was like Tyler Farengold.
Tyler Farengold's power ranking. He had the Bears
Tyler
1.
Tyler Butterball.
He had the Bears 2.
No, Tyler Butterball 100% of the Bears 1.
No, the only reason he had him 2 is because George didn't show up at his wedding.
Oh, that's right.
It's the only reason. He's still bitter about that.
He did get a nice letter, though.
Yeah. Was it a nice letter?
I thought so.
I guess so.
The fact that George,
it was a letter. It was a letter.
Yes. It was a very George letter.
It really was.
Very much so.
And it arrived on scooter. That's how George has his letters delivered. So, yeah, no. So Tyler's had him 1 and 2. No, I've got ESPN, NFL.com, Bleacher Report, CBS Sports, Fox Sports, USA Today, Sports Illustrated, Walter Sharp over at Sharp Football.
Any people that we know?
Yeah, I mean, Walter Sharp. We know Connor Orr over at SI.
Very good football writer.
I totally agree. CBS Sports is Pete Prisco. He's a bitter and acerbic man.
He is.
Yeah, and entertainingly so. NFL.com is our friend Eric Edholm.
We know him and like him quite a bit.
Yeah, so
Pete does the show with our guy Kyle Long.
Pete Prisco does?
Yeah, over at CBS Sports HQ.
There you go. Everybody's got a show, folks.
Everybody's got a show.
I'm trying to think. I would have gone Everybody is a Star, Sly and the Family Stone.
I've been watching a lot of Everybody Hates Chris lately.
Oh, so okay.
That's where it comes from.
I haven't watched the Sly and the Family Stone documentary that Questlove made.
You should.
I hear it's great. Did you watch it?
Yes.
Oh, man, I hear it's great. I loved Sly.
I would also recommend the Sly and the Family Stone. TV One did an hour on him and did on them, and it was really good.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, I
there are a lot
there.
Of people who are in love with Sly.
It was easy too. I mean, that thing was beautiful. It was multiracial, multicultural, San Francisco. You know, San Francisco hippie funk. Like, let's go. What's better than that? Not much.
Not much to my ear.
Not much in the musical universe is better than that. You could argue that it was kind of like the 3 feet high and rising of his time, or vice versa. I don't know.
Have you seen Sinners yet?
No.
I know I need to. Just for the music.
For the music, I've been told.
You got to go.
All right, I'll get there. So I'm looking at all these power rankings. Where are the Bears? Where would you guys guess the Bears are?
Okay. Boys, I'm going to let you guys go first. Okay. What do you think?
If I average it out, I would guess they'd be at about 13 to 15.
I don't have them at 13 in a single power poll. They are not above 13 in a single poll. The highest they are is the Fox Sports poll has them at number 14. That's the highest they are.
Wow, that sounds like a slap in the face.
I would say average going off of Kuhn, I would say 16th. They'll go right in the middle.
Yeah, there's a few 16s. There's two 16s. There's two 17s. Sorry, there's three 16s. There's two 17s. There's
John, 316.
There's a 19. There's a 20. And ESPN has them at number 22.
And Austin, 316, says, I just whipped your ass.
Mm-hmm. So I'd say 17 is probably the average here, maybe 18. I thought maybe somebody would have a flyer, but I guess it's not projections as much as it's current power in terms of power rankings.
Power ranking!
I just wanted to see where people thought the Bears ought to be, you know?
How do you feel about this?
I think 14 would be great. That means you're a playoff team, like bottom edge of a playoff team. I got to say, I honestly, though, I think they're going to be better than that. Am I drunk on an offseason and drunk on Ben Johnson?
Always.
It always happens, though. This from Dan Graziano over at ESPN. If the protection holds up, Caleb Williams is going to have a ton of places to go with the ball. This could be as exciting an offense as there is in the league. There's always a team that goes from last place to first place in its division. While the presence of the Lions, Vikings, and Packers might prevent the Bears from being that, if they improve enough to contend for a playoff spot, it'll probably be because Williams and all those targets have lit up the scoreboard week in and week out.
Well, the only way that they're going to be able to do that is with offensive line protection. So you guys got a chance to talk with Olin on Friday. Here's what he said about the Bears and their offensive line.
Well, and they also drafted Darnell Wright, right, and Karan Amagaji last year in the third round. So they've been drafting guys. They're just waiting for someone to develop into, I think Coach Wansett likes to call them blue, right, blue players, elite football players that you need on that offensive line. But it's always good to see them taking offensive linemen like Ozzie Tripillo, who a lot of people have respect for. Big guy, right? Can move, blocks well. A lot of people saw him as a swing tackle. A lot of people saw him more as a right tackle. Interesting to see here Ryan Poles talk about we're going to start him over there on the left side and see how he develops, because a lot of people didn't see him that way going into the draft. But we will see. And like you're saying, we've been calling for a lot of years for them to put more assets into that O-line room. And you can't complain about the amount of assets they put into their offensive line room this year with the center, Dahlman, right, they're going to move Jonah Jackson to right guard with Tooney at left guard, and now Tripillo. And then, you know, they had another draft pick, Luke Newman, in the sixth round. So they've been adding guys, Karan Amagaji, Darnell Wright. Now we just want to see that group take another step.
Got a question for you, Lawrence, and I wonder if it's my fault for how I've looked at OTAs in the past. Like, they're going to put Ozzie Tripillo at left tackle for the start right here in OTAs. That doesn't really have anything to do with where he ends up.
Correct.
I think that the way we should look at it, and hopefully the way that a good organization looks at it, is simply, how do I best use my time here in the offseason to learn what I can about these guys? Braxton Jones is hurt. You could play Karan Amagaji there, and maybe they will give him some, but
It seems like Karan's got an uphill battle.
Good. He should. But, like, you drafted this kid. You know he can play right. You might as well use your time to just let him be there, and you can figure out whether it's even an option and whether he's as an option as a swing tackle. And in that sense, I don't care what this says about who's starting there, and neither should the fans.
I agree with you 100%. Now is the time to do stuff like that. And then if he looks like he can handle all of it, and it's shorts and shells, you know, it's not real football, and even in camp, we don't get a ton of it, but at least if he looks like the workload, he understands how the offense works, what his role is left tackle, if that stuff comes easily to him, then it's the next challenge of, all right, now we're going to work him a little bit in minicamp, see how that goes. And then it's the next challenge of, let's see what his reps look like against live fire in camp, especially when we invite other teams to be a part of our practices. it makes all the sense in the world, Speak.
So the thing is, he said they want to have it locked and loaded by training camp, which is a different, an interesting thing to lock yourself into. Because I agree with you that you need to see him against live fire and potentially in a live scrimmage with opposition before you make a decision. But polls made it sound like they want a decision made at the start of camp.
Well, maybe we've got, what, 12 weeks? No, 10 weeks, right? Until camp starts, or around 10 weeks. Maybe Braxton Jones is back by then, and maybe it's not even an issue.
That he's just your starter, and you've given Tripillo time.
Yeah, and you've helped get him ready for whatever it is. As a matter of fact, why don't we listen to Olin talk about this? The idea of Tripillo seen more as a right tackle, and then him being moved to left tackle.
I've got to be honest. When I take a step back, there's things that, you know, we all say, man, I would have done this, because it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback when you're not in the building up there at Halas Hall. But when you take a step back and look at everything they've done this offseason with the coaching staff, with the guys they sign in free agencies, with the draft pick, this is a vastly improved football team. And if you think about the guys they've already have in that building, you say to yourself, okay, man, it's time for them to take a step, right? It's time for Darnell Wright to become an all-pro. It's time for him to become an all-pro, to take a leadership role in that locker room. It's time for Romo Dunze to take a step. Caleb, of course, man, he's the guy. Right, we're talking about all this stuff. It's been a luxury this year, guys, not to talk about the quarterback. Don't talk about the quarterback, but it's been a luxury for us to complain about other things. Why can't the Bears take all these other positions? Because they got their quarterback, man. And that, when you check that off, and he's got to take a step, he's got to play better. And if he does, and all of a sudden you got the mind that we all think Ben Johnson is he a leader? Can he be a head coach at his young age? Can Declan Doyle take a step, help him create schemes and plays against other teams? But as you guys can hear in my voice, the more I look at this team, the more I look at the way they're built, they got a chance, man. Now, guys got to take steps. Guys got to improve. Guys got to show they can do the things that they're capable of doing. But they have now, Ryan Pose has built a team that looks like they can maybe take a step if everyone grows the way they're supposed to grow together.
Olin getting people going with that towards the end of the segment. People like ready to run through a wall, as Olin can make you feel every once in a while. He's got legit optimism about this thing.
He does, but he's also cautious because he understands how things continue to go.
This hour is brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com. Save on dental implants today.
Being able to be in this position, being able to have a first year the way I did, ups and downs, and then to be able to come in here, be as confident as I was last year, or possibly even more, and to be able to get here with the group that we have, I really can't wait to get to work with these guys. We got a good group of guys, personality wise, and then obviously talent wise, it speaks for itself.
We know that's Caleb Williams, and this is Raheemy and Harris on the Score. Mark Grody in for Marshall Harris as we broadcast live from the Score's Hyundai studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. The question was asked, submitted by Ray Diaz in honor of Steve Rosenblum, our friend Rosie, a.k.a. the blowtorch of Saturdays in your life.
The Wake and Baker.
Yeah, and weren't you on with Rosie this weekend?
Yeah, I was. I was. See, I was a guest. I actually answered the question. So, yes, Steve Rosenblum. He and I are the founding fathers of Saturday Suckage and the Wake and Bake Club. You know the history of the Wake and Bake Club?
I mean, I know what it is, but I know he talks about it. Well, and I too understand Saturday Suckage,
Yeah.
But it's a mindset. It's a lifestyle.
WB, though, is not necessarily because Steve and I wake up smoking weed. It's because one day, years and years ago, well before it was legal to smoke marijuana in the city of Chicago, somebody called us and told us that there was like pounds and pounds of weed. There was a shortage on weed in the city. And we got people calling us and going, hey, what happened? We heard that there's a shortage of weed on the show. So we found out that day that we had a lot of Wake and Bakers, because it was like a four alarm fire to the stoners in the city of Chicago when we reported that.
Here's the
smoke
thing.
Weed every day.
Right.
Somebody had to break code at that point to report about this. So it got serious enough to where somebody thought, laws be damned, I'm going to mention this and do so in a way that was disseminated as somehow news.
Yes, it was. It was like news. And then you had people who maybe, you know, were just casual listeners who picked up the phone and called. I remember our producer, Dave White, is his name. He was taking all these calls from people and he was getting all frustrated because all these people are calling about this shortage of weed in the city of Chicago. And so that day, the Wake and Bake Club was born. And it still exists to this day.
Yeah, because Rosie is way too fired up to be on any sort of thing that implies calm.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. But he's got that California cool in him, too.
Oh, yeah,
he
does.
He's a Cali kid, you know?
I think he wore a Death Row Records shirt the last time I saw him. So shout out to Steve Rosenblum. But the question is, if the Bears have a Bengals-like season, a.k.a. the team we lovingly refer to as Bears 2...
Bears too.
And go 9-8 without making the playoffs. Would that be acceptable?
By the way, Bears 2 did draft Tyler Warren. They drafted Tyler Warren. So,
Bears 2 is also having cheerleading tryouts.
Yeah, they're having cheerleading. That's right. The Honey Bears are back. Honey Bears 2.
See, this is it's the multiverse. It's the multiverse. We could just check in alternate reality Bears right there.
I love
there.
The idea of alternate reality Bears, a.k.a. Bears 2. Like, Bears 2 is owned by a 25-year-old TikTok influencer. You know, the exact opposite of, like, legacy 100-year-old. You know what I'm saying?
They have Travion Henderson, too.
Bears 2 is run by corporate money, who does care about... They actually have standings in the spreadsheets. It's not in the actual league. You know, Bears 2 is a completely different concept.
Oh, it's amazing. They actually, the wild thing is Bears 2 drafted Shedeur Sanders in the second round with one
Shedeur
of their,
Sanders is the Bears 2 starting quarterback,
right.
Actually.
He is playing defense. He is their kick returner. So they got a lot of respect, the Bears 2 do.
If you're wondering where this comes from, it was Mike Florio throwing out a theory that before the Bengals got appropriated funding, which was actually officially approved for their stadium for renovations, that the Bengals and Bears should combine efforts and have one single stadium. And that threw Grody and I into quite the tizzy.
Right, Bears
so,
2.
Yeah, so then we just started talking about Bears 2 and how it was essentially the anti-Bears.
I got an idea Friday. I'm
You're
back
welcome
with
to
you.
Join in on the fun.
Yeah, I think we should do a Bears 2 mock draft on Friday.
Yes! Bears 2 mock draft.
It's a rule 6 draft.
Does it have to be everybody who is available in this year's draft, or can you just draft other people?
No, that's why I'm saying it's like a rule 6, like rule 5 in baseball.
Oh,
rule
yeah.
6, so you could take players off of other teams. And I've mentioned a few of the players that they have. They did draft Tyler Warren because the Bears won.
Do they
won.
Draft Jalen Carter in this scenario?
Oh, yeah, that's a good... But no, because this is new. This is a brand new franchise, so they did not have a shot at it.
Okay.
But, yeah, they have Travion Henderson, they have Tyler Warren, and they have Shedeur Sanders, and we'll fill
and
in the rest.
Somehow they have salary cap
Who's their
money?
Quarterback, though?
Shedeur Sanders.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Here's the thing about the Bengals' 9-8 season. Joe Burrow's discussion about him being an MVP candidate and the performance that he had this past year. Joe Burrow, at times, absolutely carried that team. I wouldn't even just say at times. If Caleb Williams has the type of season that Joe Burrow has, and the Bears end up going 9-8, and I have gone so far as to say that I, again, will double down on the Bears are better than a 9-win team this season. Perhaps that is wish casting, but I don't care. I'm just there in my feeling about this team at this point with this front office and how long they've been there. This should be the time. Like, you are making no excuses for your quarterback at this point. You've provided him with every possible resource that you can. I'd like to see a little more offensive line depth. I'd like to see a little bit more solid of a running back room. But point being, if that results in the same type of performance that we saw out of Joe Burrow last year, then I'm okay with it. But to take a zoom out look at it, in the fourth year of a front office with a 1-1 quarterback, you still can't make the playoffs? That's an issue.
So no good for you.
I can't be okay with it. You know, the only way I'm okay with it is if Caleb Williams has that type of season. And I don't know that is realistic. I don't even think that's a realistic expectation to put on him because this is the first year of a new offense for him.
If the Bears go 9-8 and they don't make the playoffs, awesome. Absolutely. I am 100% okay with this. Is a team that has had two 10-game losing streaks in the last 3 years, this is as close to rock bottom as the franchise has ever been. Last year was one of the worst seasons in Chicago Bears history. 5-12 and a 10-game losing streak where everything came undone in a year in which everything was supposed to be good. If you could have a winning record after that with a new head coach, with a first-year head coach, new players, a new defensive coordinator, new coaches, and a getting-to-know-you year, 9-8, I'll take. Let me just even go back here a little bit, Layla. Last 10 years, 2015, the Bears were 6-10. 2016, the Bears were 3-13. In 2017, the Bears were 5-11. 2018, how you doing, Matt Nagy? Good job. 12-4. In 2019, the Bears were 8-8. 2020, 8-8. 2021, 6-11. 2022, 3-14. 2023, 7-10. 2024, they were 5-12. 9-8, and if you do it the right way, like you said, with Caleb Williams looking good and promising, I'll take that every single day, and I won't look back.
Here's the problem. You just interpreted correctly the Bears with the Bears, but the issue shouldn't be where your bar is. The issue should be where the bar of the NFL is based on these timelines and these assets.
A 9-8 record, though, Layla, in that division, with Detroit, who's still better than you, with Minnesota, who's probably still better than you, with Green Bay Packers, who are still better than you, when you just look at what is happening right now, I take it, because that would probably mean wins in the division, too,
this is not the year. This is not a knock on J.J. McCarthy. It is a compliment of Caleb Williams when I say this. But the Bears had the chance to draft him. They still chose Caleb Williams. I can't predict that the Vikings won't have a setback when they're adjusting to a quarterback who missed his rookie season.
This is his
de facto rookie season. And until somebody figures out what's going on with Aaron Rodgers, and I don't think that he's starting in Minnesota, you know, he'd be a backup and maybe a counselor, veteran sounding board of some sort.
Their coaching is so good, though, in Minnesota. Look what they did to Sam Darnold. They gave Sam Darnold's career is back, and then some.
I had faith in Shane Waldron because of what happened with Geno Smith, and I think that has more to do with Pete Carroll now, as we found out. I think there are a lot of really good quarterbacks in the NFL who get written off too quickly because they're just in the wrong system or they're with the wrong coach.
Well, that's just
there's a bigger shortage of good coaches, actual good coaches in the NFL than there are capable quarterbacks. But here you have a 1-1 quarterback and you have what is considered the hottest coach in the coaching cycle, a very capable head coach. That has to stand for more than what we believe it to be because we observe the Bears. The standard has to be set to something else other than past history with this franchise.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I'm looking at the now, too. And when I look at the now, I say, it's pretty difficult. No matter how good Ben Johnson is, again, brand new head coach. We still don't even know if he can be a head coach. I think he's probably going to be pretty good at it, but we don't know that. We don't know if Colston Loveland's going to be good. We don't know if Luther Burden is going to be good. We don't know if Caleb Williams is going to take the next step.
But how long of a leash do these people get?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
And I'm talking about the front office with a lot of this. Think about their second pick in the draft. They didn't draft for need. They drafted what they considered the best available. So now you've got a receiver room again where you have all these assets. And we saw a quarterback last year struggle to figure out how to help them all, how to give them what we thought they were going to get with distribution, with targets, with yards, everything else.
So then wouldn't 9-8 feel pretty good? If they were to put, like you,
this
you
is
expect-
the fourth year of this front office. And if you'd keep telling me that they keep moving the goalposts when they've arguably gotten what is considered the things you need to be a successful team in the league, that is some sort of failure. I'm sorry.
Well, Kevin Warren moved the goalposts because he kept Ryan Poles here. If you want to go in that direction, like he said, you're allowed to start over. That's essentially what he has told Ryan Poles. We are also going to give you, though, the resources to go out and get Ben Johnson. You know, we're going to let you get that guy and let him bring in his staff and bring all of the potential magic that comes with him. But they are telling the Ryan Poles, yeah, you do. We are giving you a fresh start. So that stuff that happened before, unfortunately, didn't matter to the Bears. Now, if it's another horrible year this year, then we got to talk, but we got to figure out what the reasons are that the Bears were bad this year. And so much of it comes down to the quarterback and Caleb Williams. It's so important that he takes that next step, and we don't know if he's going to.
Comes down to how you built this team. The first year of Ryan Poles' draft was not a wash to me. You just prove that when you decide to extend Kyler Gordon.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
These are players that you're expecting to be a part of this when it is successful and online. And, you know, here we are talking about the 2018 season again because it is a good contrast to everything else. But I remember when we were trying to recreate that magic in the late stages of the Matt Nagy-Ryan Pace combo. And I'm like, what magic are we even trying to recreate here?
2018.
This is a team that made poor decisions once the playoff game got there. The NFL was already finding out Matt Nagy's offense toward the end of the season, if you'll recall. That's why there had to be so many trick plays and goal line packages and gold go situations, because they were having trouble executing with traditional ways of scoring. And then hubris, I guess, is what prevented guys like Tariq Cohen from getting more touches in that game. It didn't just come down to a double doink, but because they got coach of the year and GM of the year, suddenly it was trying to recreate that over and over and over again, when it should have been about the lens of just making the playoffs isn't good enough.
Yeah, Vic Fangio was the best coach of that year. Matt Nagy, he was brought in to figure out the offense, wasn't able to develop Mitch Trubisky, wasn't able to put together a running game. And guess what? The Bears defense was elite that year. For one shining year, the Bears defense was elite, and then it kind of just slid down after that.
This segment is brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com. Save on dental implants today. And I would argue also with the health of Khalil Mack. You saw the drop-off with that defense as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, for sure, Mack. I mean, you had some stalwarts on that team. I mean, Akeem Hicks is a guy that doesn't get talked about enough. He was just a total and complete badass. But, I mean, that era of...
He was a total and complete badass. He had career years when he was with the Bears.
Yeah, I will say that both Ryan Pace and Ryan Poles... both have done a pretty good job at building defenses, no doubt about it. But it's just not what, like, you need that, but it's the offense that this city has been looking for forever. And, you know, both GM, obviously Ryan Pace, ultimately failed to put together a representative offense. And now we're going to see if Ryan Poles can do it.
602, thank you. Agree with Layla. Commanders, new owner, coach, lots of new players. They should be the expectation. Danny from the Valley. Sometimes the text line breaks it up, so apparently the middle part of your text, which came after the other parts of your text, said, and look at their arrow, etc., and why can't the Bears make the playoffs? Yes, I understand you're in the toughest division in football, but I also understand that that means a lot of guys want to step it up because of it. You also got your head coach from the toughest division in football. Annie up. It's been time.
Yeah. Well,
and part of the reason we look at this team and if we say, why isn't this successful, you have to go back to wondering why they didn't build from the inside out, why you don't build from the lines first. I'm not talking about the decision to draft Caleb Williams. It's if we have this guy, why is this not working in a sustainable manner?
All worthwhile questions, for sure. And they kind of have done that, finally, the Bears, this year, with building the interior of their offensive line by drafting Ozzie Trapillo, and if you like to, a much lesser degree, Luke Newman. And then,
sure, Luke Newman can get some love in this.
Yeah, why not? He's a sixth rounder. It's like Kyle Manunga guy. This town loves a backup quarterback, and it loves a seventh round running back. It really does. Khalil Herbert was a hero when he came here.
Kyle Manunga.
Everybody
just
loves Manunga. Oh, he's going to be good. Let me tell you, Grody, he's going to be good.
Fall forward, and you'll get 2 yards.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like,
I
stretch
love this
out your
guy.
Arms a little, and we'll be happy.
Oh,
about
I
it.
Think he's going to be good. Oh, yeah. He's the old Grody. Come on, man. Look at this guy.
We should talk about this with James Big Cat Williams. He joins us at 1 o'clock. And coming up next on Raheem and Harris on the Score, it is James Fegan. Because don't look now, people, but the Sox are 3-1 this month. Yeah, that's right. We said it. James Fegan to talk White Sox next.
Sox machine.
James Fegan. White Sox reporter for SoxMachine.com.
I can anticipate this question is probably way too early.
On Twitter at JR Fegan.
Yes, James.
Asking the questions to get the answers you need.
If you knew that Abreu was available to be the runner there, would you have gone to him instead of Hendrick?
Yeah, if I'd known that, I'd know that. I'd check the rule.
I'm guessing you know the rules better. Now I know.
James Fegan on 670 The Score.
We want Machine.
Sox Machine. Machine.
We go out to the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline. Download the Circa app today. That is where we find our friend James Fegan. He is of Sox Machine. It is my favorite guest open on The Score. The White Sox beat reporter for SoxMachine.com. You can check out his work on X at JR Fegan. James, I feel like we have a lot to discuss with you. It's been a minute since we talked, and I think I want to start with not the aspect of the Sox having a good weekend, especially taking their second series of the season, which is a plus, but from the aspect of I have not talked about Colson Montgomery with you. And in the spirit of venting to guests on the midday show, which I believe was a tradition started well before me.
Yeah, I believe so.
I can't help but think that this is an indictment of the organization. When you consider how many prospects come up via trade, this person was drafted in 2021, considered at one point to be the 13th best prospect in all of baseball, talked about like he was going to be the team's opening day shortstop. And to see the fall even from March until now, I don't know how you don't look at this as some sort of indictment of the organizational health here.
It's certainly a project that they've centered a lot as being, you know, how much of that is feeling like Colson was especially marketable or, you know, a face that the fans could embrace, but someone they've centered a lot in what they feel like the future of the team is going to look like. So, on some sense, like, Colson could shake out to be like a guy who, you know, eventually figures it out, has a high strikeout rate, hits low average, but, you know, gets the 25 home runs and like still be like someone you look at like at the end of like, oh, draft in the back of the first round, you know, became kind of a mistake power hitter. All right, maybe moved off the third base. Like, that's not bad value. That's not a bad outcome. Like, useful big leaguer, but is tracking towards not being maybe the centerpiece of a winning team that they kind of marketed him as. So I think that reads as a bigger misjudgment than maybe just him not working out or any good prospect in a vacuum kind of falling backwards would say. So I get what you mean in terms of like this was someone who was really pushed as leading the charge of what the next good team is going to be, and now is probably someone you don't put in the top five organizationally or prospects. That said, like, you know, this has happened before for prospects. I don't think like Colson's done because he's going to, you know, the complex league to work out things. Like, you know, Marcus Thames even said like he had gone through that at one point in his career. It's just we're now picking up a very large sample of like not expecting this to be like a guy who, you know, walks more than he struck out, like an A-ball like he used to do, or posted like 400 OBPs and it's just going to live on base. Like, it's more like we've started seeing like the limitations in this game get really like calcified in a way that even if they kind of get him going again in a way where he's a productive player, it's probably not going to be like this, you know, best player on a division winning team type of situation. And that's really, I think, what fans are probably led to believe, and certainly coming off of feeling like they got sold a bill of goods with the last crop of prospects who didn't like kind of show up to the potential that they were billed as. I think it's going to lead a lot of people to kind of feel like, all right, same old, even if there are other projects that are going better to feel good about.
James, I appreciate you taking my call on the venting portion of the guest being on our midday show on The Score. But
are you sure that's all the venting portion?
No. In fact, I had a follow-up. I agree with you about this feeling similar. I think it also just illustrates perhaps how deep the hole they're in. When development from the minor leagues to the big leagues was such a topic of discussion as to why Chris Getz is in place to begin with. They've talked a lot about implementations of technology that weren't there previously. But at some point, you have to start seeing some of this come online in a way that isn't just from the players you've traded for. Great that we're talking about guys like Chase Meideroth. You know, great that that's happening. And great that I think Miguel Vargas has come on in a way that makes you more encouraged. But I also want to see what they're doing with their own people, too, who came up through the system originally.
For sure. I think not producing in the draft is pretty much, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why the last competitive cycle went through. But like, as far as you know, what they got out of Gavin Sheets, Jake Berger, Nick Madrigal, Andrew Vaughn, that run of like drafting super high, that was a big reason why that project kind of fell through. And I think there have been hints, like certainly having Noah Schultz and Hagan Smith. And I want to say that their last few drafts have shown a lot more promising signs, but they're critically low on bats for a system. And so for Colson to take a step backwards and what you kind of can expect him to be, even if like this is kind of the nadir and, you know, it's dangerous to overreact right now to what he is and maybe winds up being like a power hitter that people enjoy, it kind of lays bare like this is a shortcoming. That are they going to be able to address this through their last really big trade chip in Luis Robert? Is this something that they're going to, you know, invest more in the draft? They've been kind of pitching heavy because they feel confident they can develop that. How is the offense going to come in the system if the draft the kind of the most high profile draft develop project is going this direction? I can see how it contributes to the anxiety of that, which was already present before this happened.
James, it was a nice weekend for the White Sox.
It really was.
I mean, I saw good things. Even when they lost, like they made some good contact off of Hunter Brown on Saturday. I enjoyed seeing that. Yesterday, they come back from down 4-1 in the fifth to win the game. Here's the question, because I've been texted now twice, once during this show by a big time watch the White Sox no matter what. Two of my White Sox fan friends have said to me, yo, I know it's still bad. They're 10-24, but this team is different. And I feel like we want to be optimistic about it. We don't want to think about the White Sox losing 100 games again. Is this team different, better than last year's?
Well, they're on a 47 win pace, so they're comfortably striding ahead now after winning a series. I think this team I think the defense has kind of been fundamentally better, and that, you know, provides just like less ugliness on a day-to-day basis. I thought it was really instructive that they faced Lance McCullers. Obviously, I missed 3 years. First start back, Lance McCullers. But 2021, they faced Lance McCullers in the playoffs. He eats their lunch. Lance McCullers throws a ton of breaking balls, throws a ton of chase pitches. He was kryptonite for that, like, 2021 offense that was, like, way more talented than this one, but chased all the time. If you just pelted them with sliders out of the zone, they would chase them. And so, like, Lance McCullers was their undoing in that series. This team doesn't have nearly as much talent to do anything with pitches in the zone, but is very a lot better at, like, not chasing out of the zone. So it's a diminished form of Lance McCullers, but to see him make them, like, he threw over, like, 85 pitches without even getting out of the fourth inning, just kind of shows, like, they're not better, but they're a different type. And I think from a viewing experience, you appreciate the players who are maybe maximizing what they're doing with very limited tools, as opposed to seeing, like, you know, some of the most talented hitters you've ever seen kind of wasted with poor approaches. So I think they're a bit more lovable than they have been in the past. Even if love might be a strong word with how the fans feel about this White Sox team.
Yeah, 47 win pace. I don't know if that's love or not, but yeah, I hear you.
Hey, it's an improvement. Okay?
They don't inspire as much like revulsion as like how they're going about it. So it's encouraging. Like, well, if they play like this when they have more talent, it'll be better, is the kind of overriding logic.
Can we talk about Tyler Osik? I'd like to talk about Tyler Osik with you here, James. For people who don't know, Tyler Osik is a former White Sox prospect. And a tweet that he sent out that has since been scrubbed, but we haven't. I heard, and shout out to Matt Spiegel. I heard him talking about it on Hit and Run. And so I wanted to follow up with you on it today. And here is the tweet that is sent out, you know, talking about guys that there was a lot of hope for. Here's Tyler Osik. He says in a tweet, "I'll tell the truth here. Andrew Vaughn would be out in Arizona golfing, and we would all be grinding in Arizona at the facility in the off season. And he'd show up 2 times per week, dumbbell press 40 pounds, take 20 swings off the machine, show up and hit 250 with 15 bombs and 500 plus at bats, then repeat the next year. To me, that was just a slap in the face to all the people grinding to make it, given the keys to the game, and took it for granted. Promote Tim Elko."
Woo.
What do you say about that, White Sox beat writer?
I can't speak to like what Tyler witnessed in the offseason or like how representative it is of like Andrew Vaughn's entire like routine. I will say, like, you know, generally, whatever White Sox people talk about Andrew Vaughn, they kind of laud his clubhouse presence and work ethic in a way that, like, there's not, like, the results haven't been there. So it's kind of like the thing they can center on. But I think the way his career has gone, where he hasn't produced and, you know, hasn't necessarily progressed, I think it kind of invites people to kind of look at it and say, well, maybe what I saw kind of indicates why this hasn't happened for him. Whereas, like, if somebody's putting up numbers, they'd be like, that guy just knows what he needs to get ready. Whereas seeing someone who really hasn't, like, you know, chase and, you know, lack of plate discipline, is, I think, is probably the main reason he hasn't, like, progressed. And, you know, back in 2023, when there was kind of division with the White Sox about, like, our guys embracing the eye pitch and the machine work that they're emphasizing, Vaughn was part of that group that was using it, but that doesn't become like a big part of his narrative because we don't really see the progress in his plate discipline. So I think the way that his like progress is kind of stagnated, it kind of invites to say, like, hey, is this part of his routine why it's not going up? Is this thing not why it's up? Like, that's kind of comes to the territory of the lack of progress we made, even if, you know, I can't say that what Tyler said is wrong or that Andrew wasn't doing more.
Mm-hmm. No, I got you. Okay, so aside from that, completely detached from it, is Elko somebody who could or should be promoted? Is he at least right about that part, aside from the Vaughn shot?
Bears.
Uh-oh.
Sorry. I have to call. Elko is like clearly playing at a level where he's going to get promoted like at some point, and I think he inevitably plays in Chicago at some point this season. It's just a question of for any like player in Charlotte, any minor leaguer, like the front office can kind of look at it like, well, once we clear the decks of the trade deadline, this guy can play in the majors, and any productive guy in Charlotte we can try out.
Mm-hmm.
What's our rush to do it?
Right.
We have these guys that we're trying to kind of show off for trade opportunities. And I think that's going to take a bigger priority. At the same time, like, they've promoted guys like Edgar Caro and Chase Meidroff and are sensibly taking at bats away from younger players. So I think it does kind of speak to a little bit like Elko not really being a guy that they planned on really taking up and taking a longer window to be convinced in him than I think fans appreciate for someone who's kind of producing in a way that they obviously haven't seen the starting first base in the majors produce. So I think that deservedly produces a lot of attention from the fan base. But like, you're starting to hear even like Sox people go on record like, yeah, we kind of thought that guy would hit a wall at some point, or that's a guy who's gonna have to put up numbers at some point. I think Elgo's kind of outperformed in a way where he wasn't someone they envisioned being part of their long-term core. Like, you know, it was a senior signed for $35,000 as a 23-year-old in like the lowest level, who's just kind of kept getting better. But I think especially we've seen, you know, with the tone of that tweet about Vaughn and having a guy who clearly has just kind of, you know, kept improving in a way where he's kept earning his promotions, even if they weren't kind of prescribed for him, really kind of lays bare the conflict of what fans would want to see of like, hey, this guy's earned it. Shouldn't he get a shot at some point? Which I think he will, but it doesn't seem like they want to really turn away from what their original plans are that quickly to do it, even if it's, you know, inevitable. We should see plenty of Tim Elko. It's just maybe they're still stuck in plan A of like, we want to play veterans and then trade them and then restock our farm system, and not going to like alter the plan for a guy that we never really saw as like the future cornerstone until he maybe proved it to us.
Well, I think it's a good problem to have, and B, on this team of all teams, it should be something you at least consider. The delta and the difference of who's up and who's not on this team in particular, that would indicate that this is something worth a shot. I also want to point out this. The last games for Luis Robert, 8 total. This is a wild set of numbers. Hits in 7 of his last 8 games. It's a .345 batting average. 3 home runs, 9 RBI, 8 stolen bases over those last 8. First player in White Sox history with 3 home runs and 8 stolen bases in an 8-game span. How encouraged are you by his production?
I mean, a lot. I think, Getz was being asked, like, the start of last homestand about Robert and slow start, and he kind of, like, it seemed like a little crack in the facade of, like, we just wanted to keep him healthy in April. Like, we wanted him to not pull a hamstring or do something like a soft tissue injury in the cold weather. Like, they kind of feel like now that he's out of it or things are warming up, like, all right, if they've dodged that first bullet, he's eventually going to trend up, especially like you're still seeing like the bat speed, like be where it's supposed to be, taking more pitches and taking more walks than ever. Like, unless he's been like monstarred, like it should turn around. So, and especially having him kind of run wild on bases is like a big, like flashing red, like I'm healthy, like for him to do that. So yeah, that kind of felt like this was a little inevitable, but it's a lot easier to say that after seeing it for a week after, as opposed to watching him just, I mean, even Saturday, he had the golden sombrero and swinging at sliders. So that's still in him. He's still going to be a streaky player probably until his dying day. But it's a little bit easier to say like, all right, the talent's clearly in there. It seems like he's coming around a bit. Maybe it's not going to be MVP level player, but it's going to be valuable Luis Robert again.
Yeah, when you talked about the White Sox against Lance McCullers and those particular batters having trouble against the slider, the amount of years that I've spent talking about those particular batters having trouble against the slider, I made a lot of money talking about it over those years, but it also left you with some scars.
Oh, you gambled? Is that what you're saying?
No, it was my job. I was hosting when Chuck was at the ballpark. I was hosting White Sox pre and post game.
I know.
It was great, but it kind of stunk because I was like, oh no. Yes, that was the entire batting approach. James,
I remember talking with like a White Sox person like a couple years back about like, I was trying to be like overly gentle and like specific about it. Like, oh, this pitcher, he has a, his doesn't quite match up with you for like this and that reason. They thought like, doesn't match up with us. You mean he's right-handed with a slider?
Yes. Yes, that is the exact thing. All right. So it's not just me and it wasn't just our show and it wasn't just the analysts. All right. Well, I'm glad to see we all were in that space of time together. At least we have that to bind
us. The story is corroborated. Boom.
James, thanks for the therapy session, but most importantly, the information.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That was James Fegan joining us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. Coming up next, it is halftime, and I have a headline that old school scoreness listeners are going to love.
And I have something that, you ready for this? White Sox fans are going to love what I have to present. And I think I might want to add something, too. And I'll tell you guys during the break.
Ooh.
Leila Rahimi, Marshall Harris, middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
What time is it?
It's halftime.
I'm not asking you to stand up and get crunk. It's a Monday. You're probably at work, and I get all of that. Also, the weather is not cooperating, but it is halftime here on Rahimi and Harris. Mark Rohde is in from Marshall Harris. And we spent the first hour talking about the Cubs because, unfortunately, a series win over the Brewers can't just be cool. It comes with a side of worrying about Shota Imanaga as we try to figure out what's going on with his left hamstring strain, as are the Cubs. We also asked the question, do you feel better or worse after this weekend? And got a lot of varied responses. You might be surprised. Additionally, we just talked White Sox with James Fegan, and we asked a very good Rosenblum hypothetical. The Bears go 9-8 next season. But they don't make the playoffs. Is it enough?
It's halftime.
All right, so this is a headline that is just perfect for the midday show. Perfect for the sense of humor. This is the actual headline. Powerball jackpot winner arrested after kicking deputy in face. Authorities. It's okay. Just a bunch of words. It's like they took a bunch of words and just put them together, and that's what came out. I'm going to give you one guess what state this happened in.
Ohio?
Come on.
Florida.
You know it. So I think this guy just won the lottery and then decided to get crazy. Like, you can't tell me nothing.
Wait a minute.
Law officers in Pinellas County, Florida, arrested a Kentucky man who just days after winning the $167 million Powerball jackpot, allegedly kicked a deputy during a fight at a resort. Not just kicked him. He kicked him in the face.
I'm rich, bitch.
Like, how does... Yes, but also, what kind of high kick are we talking about here? That's not easy. Maybe he was down?
Oh, my God.
So, Yeah, he's in jail now, and he did actually, according to the affidavit, kick him in the face. Jesus. His name is James Farthing. He was charged with felony battery on a law enforcement officer. But here's where it gets interesting. His girlfriend was also arrested. Her name is Jacqueline Fightmaster.
No, now you're making stuff up.
This is fake. This is a fake story.
No, you got AI'd.
See, a woman with the name...
I did not. This is a reputable news source. Oh,
that's a verb now. You got AI'd.
You've been AI'd.
A woman with the name Fightmaster isn't going to get with anybody that can't kick somebody in the face.
So she was charged with... She was charged with disorderly intoxication, and this came 3 days after winning the Powerball jackpot in Kentucky. Oh, is that the first thing you would do after you won the lottery? Oh. Just start fights with whoever? Imagine and your girlfriend's name is Fightmaster.
Unlimited bail money.
Imagine that. Wake up. You know, we've all done that where we wake up after a night of drink. We're like, oh my God, what did I do? What did I say? Imagine that pain. Oh my God, dude, you kicked a cop after you won the lottery. What?
In the face.
In the face.
Nobody makes me bleed my own blood. Mark Grody.
Are you ready for me?
Yeah. It's nap time.
So, I noticed that in the White Sox game, you guys don't think I watch the White Sox. I do.
They don't think any of us watch
I know,
the White Sox.
I know. I was watching them all weekend long, and one thing that I saw was Jeff Blum throwing out the first pitch of one of the games. And he was doing it in, I was very proud, in a White Sox jersey. He's a Houston broadcaster. He is loyal.
Yeah, I used to work with him.
Exactly. So you know he is much more loyal to his days playing with the Houston Astros from whence he came when the White Sox made the trade for him. He feels like he's a Houston Astro, not a White Sox. So I was happy with him. And then it reminded me of one of the greatest moments in White Sox history. I was there. Game 3 of the World Series, October 28th in the 14th inning.
Longest game in the World Series history. Blum hits it into right down the line. It is gone. Jeff Blum, the former Astro, goes deep. And here in the 14th inning, the White Sox take a 6-5 lead. Jeff Blum gets his first at bat of this series and only his second of the postseason.
White Sox end up winning that game 7-5 in 14 innings. Damaso Marte the win. Mark Burley the save. And then the White Sox win the whole thing on October 4th the next day as they beat Houston 1-0. Freddie Garcia over Brad Lidge and Bobby Jenks with the save. It was so nice. That was one of my favorite sports experiences ever, was following the White Sox on that World Series run from Boston to Anaheim through Houston and then on the field afterwards with Steve Perry and all the other White Sox. It was great.
Never in a million years thought I would end up working with Ozzie Guillen, you know? Crazy how life will come at you that way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ozzie Guillen. That's when Kenny Williams and Ozzie Guillen were besties. Kenny Williams, after that game, where's my manager? Where's my manager? I'm down on the field, and all he's worried about is, where's Ozzie? And they embraced, and boy, did they love each other then. I'm so sad that the whole thing went downhill.
Mark Burley gave Jerry Reinsdorf the ball, too. At the parade.
Yeah, oh, it was just...
The memories.
No, that was a beautiful thing that should have lasted longer, and... Yeah.
Yeah. Quite the story about Mark Burley coming on in relief, by the way. But that's another story for another day, because we have a pretty unhinged five on it next
Drinkowitz.
For you. Mark and I just started to go stream of consciousness, and you get to judge. You get to have some judgment coming up next, along with some sports talk. This is Raheemy and Harris, Mark Grody on The Score.